My name's Rich, Rich Griffin. That's my Twitter handle there if you need to get in contact with me. I've got some other contact details which I'll show you at the end. What I'm going to talk about today is how we build a potential way of building pretty hardcore data-driven apps on the phone. I think the session's marked as 300, but it's probably more of a 400 session. So I don't know if that makes you want to rethink whether or not you want to stay. We're going to cover some pretty hardcore topics like dependency injection and single responsibility and IOC and all of that, RX and that kind of stuff. So if you're happy with that sort of level of technical detail, awesome. If you're not, stick around. I will try and make it simpler for you. They're not mind-blowing. I mean, wow, if I can do it, then I'm pretty certain you guys can do it. So before we start, I just had these links up on the site. So this is something called the Windows Phone 7 Contrib that I run. I don't know if you've heard of the Contrib before. Anybody heard of the Windows Phone 7 Contrib? Boo. So what is the Contrib? The Contrib, basically, when I started looking at the phone development stuff, loads of really, really cool bits and pieces flying around on the internet. And the Contrib is aimed at bringing all of this really great stuff and pulling it into one single place for you. Very recently, we created a whole set of NuGet packages. So do you guys use NuGet at all? Okay. Cool. So if you want to use NuGet to get the Contrib bits, you can do that as well. So it makes it really simple. I have a slide about the Contrib, which we can look at shortly. But that's the site up on Coplex. Okay, so anybody building phone apps for the Windows Phone 7? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Wow. So what are you building phone apps on then? Android? iOS? Okay. How about Silverlight? Anybody building anything in Silverlight? Okay, there's a few more. WPF? Okay, a few more. Cool. So why am I showing you the Windows Phone 7 app site template? That's really because when you guys start building your phone apps and you want to sort of market your app, well, how do you do that? You know, you've got to create, you know, put something up on the marketplace, but potentially you want to get a wider audience looking for your awesome app that you've put up there. What we created was this little website. This one is for FinderPad, which is an app that I built. You take all the HTML from the Codeplex site, you put it up on your web server, you fire up the emulator in Windows Phone 7 with your app in it. You take your screenshots, stick them all together in a folder, FTP them, and you get a site like this. It's a really, really simple way of helping you guys market your app, so hopefully you find that useful. MVVM Lite Toolkit. Okay, a couple of people. So this is at our core, effectively, of the Contrib, and everything that I'm going to show you is kind of based around MVVM Lite Toolkit. If you haven't used the toolkit, that's not a problem. It's an MVVM-style pattern, which you've probably heard too much about. And the other thing that I use is something called a mediator pattern from the Gang of Four, which Lauren actually calls the messenger, but standardized patterns that I'll show you. Okay. Another interesting bit that I use in my Silverlight apps and my phone apps is something called Funk. And Funk is a really fast DI container, really lightweight dependency injection container. It's really, really nice. I know it's a bit weird to get excited about that, but one of the exciting pieces which I'll show you is it uses lambdas. So it's really clean, and it's just nice and simple for you to get hold of. Okay, so those are all the kind of those bits. So let's get into the meat. All the code that I'll show you is up on this URL, so you can go and get that if you want to. If you want to add to it, email me and say, hey, Rich, I've added this. If you've got questions about the code, fire them over. And anything really to do with what you see, just shout. Okay, so what is data-driven? Well, you could pretty much argue every app that you build today, whether that's in a XAML-based technology or PHP or C++, you are processing data. So let's get some context. So the context that I'm going to talk about is we're on a phone. It's a small device. It's nowhere near as big and hard processing as my laptop or the box underneath my desk. I know that sounds obvious, but we have to put this into perspective. And all of the data that I'm going to get is from some sort of third party who have absolutely no control over what they give me. So there are a number of problems that we've got to deal with. So what is data-driven? For me, data-driven is four main pieces. We've got to get the data, we've got to retrieve the data from somewhere. I've got to process that data. I've got to visualize my data, because once I've got it, I need to render it out on the screen. It's pretty useless if I've got an app that doesn't actually show the user anything. And there's virtualization, which is all about caching and performance. Okay, so let's dig into each one of these. So what you'll see in this session, how do we retrieve the data? I'm going to show you some techniques. There are RX-based techniques. They're boilerplate pieces of code. So even if you haven't done any RX, you should be able to pick these boilerplate pieces of RX up, put them into your app, and you'll have complete asynchronous getting of your data, which is quite nice. JSON, pretty much exclusively deal in JSON. And to deal with the JSON, I use something called JSON.NET Serializer, which is up on Coplex. I don't know if anybody has seen or heard that. That's really very cool for dealing with JSON. You can deal with XML if you want to. And our other mechanism, which I'll show you, is some caching pieces around the retrieval, so that if we're making multiple requests for the same thing, we don't keep hitting the server. We look at our cache and bring in the data. Okay, so once we've got the data, we need to do something with it. We need to process it. We need to handle it. And I'll show you some architectural pieces that I do. I'm not saying that you have to do it that way, but it's just the way that I found works really nice. How do we manipulate the data? And once we've got the data, because we're in the land of XAML and we have data binding, I want to take absolute, total control over the fact that I can bind everything up in XAML. It's nice and easy, and everything's quick for me to develop. Awesome. But there's some caveats as well. So up in the cloud where I'm getting my data from this third-party endpoint, I have no control over how they, you know, set up their tables. What's their architecture for their data? I have no control over it. And the UI that I want to build, well, doesn't naturally map onto these resources that are in the database. So there's something in here which is called map and wrap, which I'll talk about quite a lot. And effectively all that is it's taking the resources from the endpoints, squeezing them into a model representation, and I then bind this model up to my view using data binding, and hey, that's part of the power of XAML. One of the other things that's on there is the model needs to support IMPC. What is IMPC? IMPC is the... what is IMPC? Actually, I've completely forgotten. It's an iNotify property changed mechanism. So if you've done Silverlight or WPF, there's this property change mechanism that happens. So when your data changes, you get fired an event, and hey-ho, you've got two-way binding in place. The other thing to remember is the model that I have on the client, well, that may also contain business logic, which is completely irrelevant to the third party. So how do we visualize this data? Lots of UI controls out there. There's a few here. We can put the points on a map. We can put them into a list using a list box. We can put them on there using tiles. We can even use charting. Different ways that we want to render this data that comes back. And the final piece, which is kind of the underlying crux to everything that you see, is how do we virtualize the data? How do we get this performance on the handset so that we can handle really large amounts of data? And I'll show you some stuff that's in the contrib, which covers the caching and the persistence pieces for the data that comes back. Okay. So while I'm talking and showing you lots of code, just remember that really, ultimately, why am I doing all this? And it's all about user experience. In order for users to love your software, they've got to have a great experience. And that also kind of permeates with everything that we'll see. Yagni, anybody know what that means? Yeah, you ain't going to need it. So on the phone, if you don't need to process the data, don't do it. If you don't need to do something, don't do it. Just defer it. Just keep on deferring it until you absolutely have to do it, and then use the processing power that you have to do that. Otherwise, what you'll find is you'll hit the 90 meg limit, your app will just get cleaned up, and that'll be it. User will be sat there looking at the home screen going, what happened to that? Okay. So what's in your toolbox? Tools that we need, Visual Studio 2010 phone development and Blend for Windows Phone 7. Those are the things that are free. Obviously, you can pay for them if you want to. Everything else that I show you is open source. It's completely free. For you to go ahead and use and contribute back to. And those are the four main things that we've kind of touched on. Okay, so what's in the contrib? Lots of great stuff in the contrib, really. One of the big things that people asked for was tombstoning. I don't know if, for those guys that have done Windows Phone 7 stuff, tombstoning... With the stuff that I show you, it's two lines of code. You tombstone your whole app, two lines. So it's really nice. We've extended the messaging. So we have some really nice extended messages from Laurent's MVVM Lite. We've extended the collections as well, so they're thread safe. We've also got some page list view collection stuff, which wasn't in Windows Phone 7 previously. Services, we've wrapped up location and navigation. So again, if you want to put some sort of location-based thing, feature functionality into your app, two lines of code. UI controls, lots of great UI controls in there. The most important one really for me is the transition. So all of our transitions are done in C# rather than in XAML, and that means that you'll always see your transition happen. Unlike some of the ones in the toolkit where if your app's under pretty heavy load, you'll just see 0 and 1. Where's my transition? UI thread can't process it. The other thing that's not up on there, which is the mapping piece, I did quite a lot of work with Bing Maps. You know, most of the time you're doing Bing Maps work, what you'll do is hit WSDL. It's pretty heavy. And on the phone, you need something light. So I built a whole wrapper around Bing Maps. So if you want to put location and you want to put maps into your app, it's probably 4 or 5 lines of code. So hopefully those wrappers really help you to be super productive. Okay, so I'm just going to switch over to the phone for a minute. And I just want to show you an application that we built that really is the essence of the presentation and everything that came with the contrib. So this is a little application to help you find properties. I'm going to search in London. And hopefully if my connection works, we get the properties come back. I can scroll through the list of properties. I can select a property. Nice transition. Come into something called a pivot control. I'm using charting here as well, which is rather nice. We get some charting information about the house prices in the area. We can get crime information as well. Again, all of this data that you see is coming over the wire down onto my handset from third-party APIs that I have no control over. Okay. So should we be daring and see if we can get a route? Let's see what happens. So now I'm using the Bing Maps control, and hopefully it's going to come back and tell me how I drive from here to this property in London. Wow, cool. So I've got my different directions. I wonder how I get across the... Oh, take the tunnel. No. I'm in London now. I'm in the... Anyway, get the idea. James Bond style boat, okay. And the other thing I want to show you is just the maps. Most important thing is where are the pubs? Wow, look at that. There's one just around the corner. Fantastic. So I can find different pieces of information that I want. Again, all this information comes from Bing. And at the bottom, there's a phone number, so I can say, hey, can you organise taxis for me for getting back? This is in control in the contrib, and basically it's picked up that it's a phone number, and it's taken care of everything for you. If that was an email or a Twitter account, it would help you out as well. So literally, you just data bind your content up to the text box, the smart text box, and it will provide all these features for you. Okay. And the final thing I just want to show you very quickly is not as exciting, but quite interesting. So when we're on the phone, we have three different types of connection. I can be connected to 3G, I can be connected to a Wi-Fi, or I can be hardwired into my machine, potentially using some sort of Ethernet connection. And those different connectivity types mean that, you know, my experience is potentially degrading when I move from a Wi-Fi connection point to a 3G connection point. So I built this screen really so that as a user, you could change the amount of data that's coming down depending on your connection type to hopefully help enhance that experience. So rather than saying, you know, when I'm on 3G, give me pages of 50 results, we've wound that down to be 10 so that you're only getting 10 pieces of information at a time. So hopefully that helps with the experience. Okay, so that was Finderpad. And what we'll do is we'll take steps to try and get to, and I'll show you the problems that I had to get over in order to get to that stage. Okay, so let's start with V1. So V1 really is a POC, a proof of concept. We're building this to make sure that, hey, can we actually build it? Can I actually call these services? Can I get the data back? Can I prove that I can actually build this? Okay. So let's have a look at version 1. Version 1 is pretty simple. Hopefully we'll have something running in a second. Okay, so very, very simple. Pay note, if you can, to the values that are on the right-hand side. The most important one at the minute, if you can see that, which you might not be able to see that well, is the memory. I'll shout that out anyway. So I'm going to do a search. I'm going to hit Nestor your endpoints. Bring back some JSON. It's paginated for me, and it's bringing back 50 properties every time I hit it. And you can see here, we're searching in London, and it's brought back 43,000 results. Quite a number of items to put in a list box. And when we do the next page, we increase by 50. I've put some simple counters up here so that we can see what the the memory usage is, and we can see the delta. And we can still see that the delta does go up, but it's not too bad. And my memory is, we're running down at like 12 megabytes. But we're not really doing much, so we would expect it to be fairly low. Okay, so let's go and have a look at the code. And I just need to make sure that we're looking at the right project. And we'll go here, and page.xaml. Let's just get rid of this. Can we all see that? Okay, do you want me to make it any larger, or is that a bit bigger? That's what they all say. A bit more? Let's go 1 to any. Yeah? I can crank it up a bit more if we want. Don't want you straining your eyes. Okay, so this is the URL that I'm hitting, and I've just got some variables in there, so very, very simple stuff, probably doing this at the moment. And what I want to show you is potentially how you're doing this today. So let me see if I can actually get some more. Let's get rid of some of this stuff up here. I get a bit more space for you guys. There we go. Okay. So potentially how you're doing this at the moment, or one of the ways that you're doing this at the moment, is using a HTTP web request. I'm doing this asynchronously, so we're saying, you know, make the request, lovely jubbly. Get a hold of the response stream, so we get that response stream back. We use the JSON reader, we pipe the stream into the JSON reader. JSON reader starts reading, we serialize the JSON, then we deserialize the result. We do this thing called map and wrap, so we take the resources that have come from our endpoint and we map those into our model object, and we pump them into an observable collection called properties. And then we go and update the UI with the results. So not overly complicated, but messy. And when you have a number of these happening in your application, for me, I found that I was finding a management nightmare in my head. It was just sort of things were going wrong, and I couldn't really understand why, because I had so many of these happening. And when you incorporate that with multi-threading, painful. So what's the solution? So a potential solution is for us to use Rx, wherever my method has gone. So this is a different approach, and this approach is the way that the contrib does this, and it uses Rx to do it. Rx is very functional, which means that sometimes it's a lot easier for you to read and understand. So what are we doing? We've got our resource client, which comes from the contrib. It's wound up to an interface. We knew that up. We use Rx to make the request, and we say, you know, Rx says, well, what URL are you going to use for the get? Well, we're going to use this Nestoria URL template that we saw earlier. We want to go and get the result. Where are we getting the result from? We're getting the result from the data that comes back. How do we want to process this? We want to observe on the dispatcher. So we're observing on the dispatcher UI thread, so that we're trying to be non-blocking as possible. And we subscribe up to the result. When the result comes back, we do what we did previously, which is map and wrap. And we add these properties into our properties observable collection, and then we go and update the UI. So for me, I find that cleaner than the HTTP web request mechanism. Yes, it's using Rx, and that's a whole new gambit of stuff that we have to understand, but with the resource client out of the contrib, you can pretty much copy and paste this code and put in a new URL template, and boom, you've got everything you need. Okay. So what did we see? We saw the resource client in action with some Rx sizzle-dizzle. The resource client, which you probably don't get a handle of at the moment, uses a generic communication pattern, which is all based on get and post. So it maps really nicely to the HTTP verbs that we use. And we saw some really simple map and wrap. What are the bad parts? Well, our app is just this massive, amorphous blob of stuff. We'd carry on building our app like that if we wanted to, but we can do better than that. We should be more pragmatic in our approach. And also, you know, if I put the app up onto the marketplace, realistically, who is going to buy my app? Not many people. Maybe some geeks out there. Okay, so data visualization. So how do we go from having this fairly boring looking app to make it into something that looks a lot nicer? Okay. So in order to do that, I need to change my architecture. And this is where we're going to get into some of these concepts. So we use Func. Func is our dependency injection. We have something called a bootstrapper. And the bootstrapper effectively is just responsible for doing our plumbing and our scaffolding and setting all of our things up that we need for our app. We have a view. We have a view model locator. We have a view model. We have a model, and we have some services. So we're trying to separate concerns and say, hey, you know, services, if you're dealing with property services and you're calling an endpoint, you need to live in that services area. If you're model objects that I'm using to render to my view, you need to live in the model area. And any view models that we use live in the view model area. Any views that we have live in the view area, and so on. Okay. So this is what we're going to do. We're going to do some separation of concerns. We're going to put in a service layer. I'm going to show you some DI. And we'll use the contrib to help us. So here we go. Hold on to your hats, Dorothy. So let's move into V2. Let's start with a bootstrapper. I hope you guys like my colour scheme. And effectively, what Func says is that you have to provide something to configure your container, and that's what we're doing here. And we're basically saying, what are all of the pieces that my app needs in order to work? I need a logger. Always good to have some sort of debug log. Is that a bit too big? Let's go 125. Is that okay? So always good to have some sort of logging information when you're debugging. The next thing that we do is we set up our mediator pattern. One of the things that we found was that on the phone, when you want to pass data between views, there are really two mechanisms of doing this. First way is an ASP.NET style mechanism where it's a query string. We put some stuff in the query string and pass that. I don't personally like that approach. So the other way of doing it is by using a mediator pattern. There's a problem with that, though. If I'm a view model and I've been instantiated, I'm firing out messages, but potentially there are no other view models available. And when the user moves and navigates, it hasn't got any data because it wasn't instantiated when I, the view model, sent that message. So the last message replay messenger what it does is says, well, when another VM is invoked, I'm going to replay the last message. And if that VM is interested, it will pick it up and deal with it. Next up, we register a navigation service. So this is help you with navigating between pages. Pretty simple. Say hello to the resource client again. So this time we're putting this into our whole scaffolding piece, and we're newing up a resource client factory, and we're passing in the log so that the resource client can log things for us. Next up is our property service. And the property service takes the resource client because it needs to use that in order to make that communication channel and call the services that we need on the endpoint. And we also pass in the log. So if you haven't done any DI before, what is the important takeaway? Well, the important takeaway is just to remember, you register things. So register things. And then once I've registered them, when I want to use them, I have to call this resolve mechanism. So you can see on the search view model that the search view model takes a number of parameters, and I pass them in using the resolve. So I register what I need, then once I need that, I call the resolve and I pass those into the constructor. And that's really the whole purpose of the dependency injection piece, is that rather than having all of this new stuff, newing up lots of objects inside of your view model, you're actually passing them in. And once you start passing them in, that means that you can mock them. And as soon as we can mock them, we can isolate our classes, we can write unit tests for them and really hammer them and make sure that they're doing what they need to do. The other thing with DI is that it forces you down a certain route. And when you don't go that route, you get a lot of friction. It's very, very difficult once you start using DI to go against it. And actually, that's a really, really good thing. It's a blessing in disguise, because what this approach does is it forces me into separating my concerns and forcing me into single responsibility patterns. So it's a good thing to have at the core. Okay, so that was a bootstrapper. Let's go and have a look at the property service. So this is my property service. I just took the code out of the main page before and blasted it in here. And this is going to do all of the request response. You can see that we've got our RX bit of sizzle dizzle here. Exactly what we were doing before. Sorry, the screen thingy needs to be a bit higher. Same as what you saw before. Same RX, sizzle, dizzle, boilerplate, copy and paste it. We've got a couple of extra things there, which is on error, go do something, because it's not too good to be blowing up. And then when we're completed, go do something else. Okay. Let's have a quick look at the model. So this is my model. It's called property. Believe it or not, this is going to be the model object that holds property information. On the resources client, you know, the stuff that comes down from the endpoint, I can't remember what it's called, but it's definitely not called property. Let's actually go and have a look at that. I think it might be called listing, actually. So on my client side, in my model, I've got something called property. And what Nestoria call that is a listing. And I just map different properties from the listing into my property model object, which I then, you'll see in a minute, go and bind up in the UI using data binding. And this is this stuff here that you see, all these attributes, this is from JSON. .NET serializer, give yourself RSI typing this stuff, but there we go. Okay, so let's have a look at the view models. So all of the view models derived from something called view model base, which I don't really want to get into, but if you guys download the code or afterwards, I'm happy to talk about that a little bit more. You can see that the search view model takes some parameters inside of its constructor, which are the things that we resolved when we pumped them in. One being the property service, the other being navigation, and we need to pass messages, so we hammer that in there as well. Okay. And we should see some messages somewhere. And I've just got other things in here that I'm binding to, which, you know, we need. I might just crank that down a little bit so it's a bit easier to see. Because it's all... No, I can't. Okay. So this is where the action takes place, really, in the execute search. And we do this property search here. And what are we searching on? The place name that we saw in the text box. We observe on the dispatcher. We're subscribing to the result that comes back. Once we get that result, we send a message. One of them being a search criteria message, and then we send another message, which is the results message. And believe it or not, the results view model needs to pick that message up, and we'll see in a minute how that registers. Once we've sent the messages, then we need to navigate to the results page, and we can see in there that, slap my hand, if there's an exception... I'm not doing anything, so really I should put some tidy up code in there or something. So that's our search view model. That's the thing that we see at the start. It's wired to the search view. It's the thing that powers what's behind the text box. It's the thing that's going to make the initial request for us. I just want to quickly show you the results view model. This is the thing that's going to render the results out on the screen. What do I have here? I have an observable collection. We need a list of properties so that we can bind them up to the view. Okay, so this is quite interesting. I have a relay command here. Why do I have a relay command? If you think back to the FinderPad demo, one of the things that really bugs me quite a lot is I start an app up. It's going and getting data from somewhere. I get a list. I scroll down the list, and there's a button at the bottom that says, click here to get more data. What? What do you mean? I can't just keep scrolling the list? You making me action something? I don't like apps like that. We can do a lot better. We can keep scrolling. And as we keep scrolling, just keep getting more data. The way we do that in this particular version is I use something from Daniel Vaughan. And the thing from Daniel Vaughan, let's just crank this up a little bit, is this thing. It's called the Scroll View Monitor. And the Scroll View Monitor basically says, in that viewport, when you start getting 20% from the bottom, go get more data. And the way that it goes and gets more data is it fires a command. And that's the command that that you saw a second ago, which is called select load more search items command. Wow, that's quite a long one. And basically what happens when you get to 20% at the bottom, an event gets fired, the command picks that up, and what happens? Well, we go and execute a search. So that's a nice way to give a better experience than having the user action go get more data. Bit clunky, I think. So the results view model, it needs to get data from somewhere. And as we saw in the search view model, well, the search view model is sending messages. And we can see here on 39 and 40, this is how this view model picks up the messages, blah, blah, blah. And it does that by just registering for them. So if you've done pub/sub stuff before, very, very similar. Okay. I've got an observable collection. That's the thing that we're binding to. I've got my execute search. Okay. and my execute search is very similar to what we saw before, really. Bit of Rx sizzle dizzle, going and doing another search. So when we scroll down, we get to 20%. We do another search, go get the data, map and wrap it, add it to the UI, bind it. We're all good to go. Okay. So, hang on. There is one more thing, I think. And that is the UI. So for you guys that have done XAML before, what I'm doing here is I create a folder called resource vault. And for those people that haven't done XAML, what is in the resource vault? Well, what's in the resource vault are things called resource dictionaries. And resource dictionaries are the styles and the templates that allow us to customize the look and feel of our controls. And I break these up, so hopefully this starts to make sense. Common controls, text boxes and buttons. All the styles and templates live in common controls. Converters. Converters are really, really cool, but they're pretty heavy on performance as well. I put all my converters into a separate place so that when I create a converter, I know where it lives and I don't get confused. And we're going to see a similar story. Data templates. The data template holds the list box items. And this is all the stuff that you'll see in the list box item. Lots of lovely XAML-y type stuff. And what lives in the toolkit controls? Well, would you believe it? Styles and templates for toolkit stuff. So it means that when I've been to the pub and I've come back and I do something, hopefully I've still got enough brain cells working that allow me to understand where to put things. Okay, so... okay, let's see if... Sorry, let me just... start this up again. Oh, sorry, I'm in the wrong project. I need to be in version 2. Unfortunately, I can't show you both screens at the same time, but maybe if I can get this output window up, you can see this. Okay. So this is version 2. We're going to search in London like we did before. Our memory is about 10 megabytes at the minute. Hit the search. Go get the data. Okay. Start scrolling, things start disappearing. Oh, where's it gone? Okay, memory is 27, 26, 28, 29. So our memory's going, oh, we hit 30 then. Once everything's loaded, and we've got 180 items in there, it's pretty good. But as things are being pumped into the list, that's when we see the problem. You saw the whole black screen. I'm scrolling. Where's everything gone? And it's back again. Oh, my God. Wow. What happened there? What's happening there is the fact that we're slamming so much data into our observable collection. Our observable collection is firing IMPCs, I notify property changed events. It's firing so many of these that the UI thread is just kind of going, oh, my God. So we lost control of the data, which is not great. The other thing that we do as well is, with me just scrolling aimlessly down, with me just scrolling aimlessly down that list, what I'm actually doing is every time I scroll down the list, I'm firing off another request. So we've got all these other requests going out, even though I don't actually need to be making the request. So still not really very, very slick. Okay. So what do we see in version 2? Separation of concerns, which hopefully you guys will agree that we have a better structure. And we've got a clean service layer in place now, which mirrors exactly what we want to be getting back from the service, which is nicer. What are the bad parts? Well, we went from an app, which, okay, was fairly simple and running at back 9 to 12 megabytes of memory, to something that's maxing out 33 megabytes. And we have two pages. My app is potentially going to be 6 pages or more, you know. I'm going to hit that 90 megabyte limit pretty soon. And when I hit the 90 megabyte limit, the sweeper's going to come along and just take my app out because you can't exceed 90 megabytes. So that's going to be a problem. The other problem that we saw was UI performance. We saw the fact that when I scrolled through that list and we started adding the items, then the UI just disappears. And as we said earlier, the thing that we want to achieve is a great experience. That's not a great experience. So what do we need to do? Well, one of the things that we can use, one of the techniques we can use is data virtualization. So I hope you like my amazing artistic flair that I have. But what is this all about? Well, I've tried to sort of explain this in a number of ways to a number of different people, and sometimes the message just gets lost. I guess sometimes that's because we're in the pub, but hopefully this illustration, as simple as it is, will help us get a grip on what we're doing. So when we're going to get the data, we put the data into an observable collection. Observable collections are awesome because they notify our view to say, hey, there's a new bit of data, and automatically we see that data appear on the screen. Awesome. But as you saw, we're adding so many items so quickly that this iNotify property changed events are happening so frequent and so often that the UI just can't deal with all of the stuff that we're sending it. So we've got two options that we can do. Our first option, we could batch. So we could say, hey, let's just batch up 10 or 20, and then we'll push them into the observable collection, and then we'll go and get another 20. When we've got another 20, we'll take those and we'll do it that way. That's one potential option. The other option, which I'll show you how to use, is something that I call a trickle collection. And basically what the trickle collection is it's a tap on the pipe. Rather than just having this massive pipe of data coming out and hitting the UI, we've put a little tap on there, and we're regulating the flow of the volume of the liquid, or the data in our case, that's coming through the pipe. And what that means is that I can hold off the data that I'm getting back from the service and the data that I'm putting up onto the view by having this thing in the middle, and that helps me regulate how much data is going out and into the UI. Which, what does that mean? Well, it means I've regained control over my data. Awesome. Okay. And this is really technical and really difficult, so I have to be very quiet for a minute while we concentrate very hard. I'm joking. Sorry. It's my British sense of humour. Doesn't travel very well. Do we need to stop? Yeah, we need to stop. That would help. Okay, so let's go and look at version 3. Set a startup project. What do we do? Where does all the action take place? Well, all the action takes place here in the results view model. That's the thing that's sort of powering our view, this list of search results. Line 25, that's my observable collection that we were using before. I've still got my relay command in there. What I've done is I've added a little flag as well for search in progress, so hopefully we kind of know when the search is happening and when it's not. But the thing that's most important for this particular version is this bit of stuff here, which is called the trickle auto collection. And this is what's going to do the job of data virtualization for us. So let me just collapse some of this stuff so we can get to the thing a bit easier. Okay. So everything starts again. Sorry, I should have possibly ordered those a little bit differently. So everything starts again here in the search mechanism. Search view model's done a search. It's passed us the data. We've put it out in the UI. User's scrolled. We've got 20% down to the bottom. We need to do another search. This method gets called. We use some Rx. We go and set up and start the trickling. And this is where the sizzle happens. So it's pretty simple. We've got a trickler. We knew up the trickler. And we have two things that we need to pass in. We need to pass in something that can deal with when something is added to the trickle collection. And we need to have something that deals with when that trickle collection has completed adding in the items. And once we've done that little bit of setup, we need to kick the trickler and kick it off and say startup. And for this particular instance, I'm using 33 milliseconds. I don't know why, but it seemed good at the time. Yes, this is all down to playing. Yeah, you know. It's a bit of a magic number. Might blow my handset up, I guess, but that's what we're doing there. And then, you know, what are the other things that we pass in there? Let's actually get some help up here, and you can see this. So we need to pass in a source collection. So the collection we get from the endpoint, we need to stuff that into the trickler, and then the destination. We need to say, where do you want me to put these things in this timely fashion? So the trickler really is stood in the middle. He's a middleman, and he's taking the data from here, and then every 33 milliseconds, he takes an item and he pushes it in, and then he waits 33 milliseconds, and he goes and gets the next one, and he pushes it in. And this is what he's doing. And it just that little bit of a delay, well, you'll see the effects in a minute. So two lines of code, not too bad. You can use this in Silverlight or WPF as well if you wanted to. If you've got really heavy data processing that you need to do, but it's a fairly simple technique in order to give your UI the performance that you want. And I think that is all of the sizzle dizzle. So let's... sorry? Did I? Very well spotted, sir. And we've got the right one sorted. Okay. So let's go and see what happens. Let's get this... Oh. Okay, so we're back at the familiar screen. I'm going to do a search. Memory's running about 14, 16, something like that. You see when I get to the bottom, we're going to get more data. I'll scroll back up a minute. So my frames aren't dropping. Scroll through the list. Smoother scrolling. How much memory are we using? We're up around 24 megabytes. So we've reclaimed some of that memory. We lost some frames there, so performance still not as good as what it could be, but definitely a marked improvement on what we had before. Okay. Okay, cool. So let's stop this for a second. So pretty simple technique, and we've reclaimed, I don't know, between 8 and 10 megabytes. So nice. OK. Okay, so what did we see? So a potential technique for you to regain control over your data when you're using data binding. I definitely think we should maintain, you know, one of the amazingly beautiful things about WPF and Silverlight and XAML technology is that we can use data binding. So we don't really want to throw that away. We definitely want to use that. And we've also improved the infinite scrolling. So it's a bit smoother as we scroll through. Bad things, we've increased, but we've decreased in certain areas. And our UI performance is still, it's not great. We're still dropping the frames. Not a great experience. So the final version is all about performance. So there is more that we can do. We can put some caching in at the service layer. I'm going to show you some in-memory techniques for that. In the contrib, we do provide an isolated storage mechanism for that. So obviously, you know, when I'm putting things into memory, as soon as I kill the app, all of the stuff that I put into memory is gone. So when you fire up the app again, you're going to make a whole load of requests. Whereas if you want persistence between sessions, then you're going to want to put that into something that persists, you know, between when your app is alive and when it's not. I'm going to show you how to improve the image loading. So we're going to go and get the images asynchronously. So it means as we scroll down the list, if I'm scrolling pretty quickly through that list and I stop, I'm just going to go and get the items that are in the viewport. And once I've got those, I'll then sustain and suspend and resume and go and get the ones that are higher up the list. So when I scroll back up there, hopefully we'll be there. And I'm going to refactor the layout controls that I'm using because I'm using quite a lot of XAML. Now, at this point, when your PM or your manager or the business owner says, you know, come on, Rich, you've been working on this for ages. We need to get this thing out. Like, well, we could change the user experience. That is a potential that we could do. If we're, you know, still living in this dream world that my handset is as powerful as my laptop, then we need to rethink our experience that we have on the phone. So potentially at this point, and this was a serious thought that we had when we were building FinderPad, was, hey, we just can't do this on the phone. We've got to change the experience. Anyway, I'm pretty stubborn, so I didn't do that. And I created some other bits, which hopefully you guys will find useful. So what I want to just do here, first of all, is look at the XAML. So let's have a look at Blend. Anybody seen Blend before today? Okay, awesome. Likey. Who's using Silverlight and WPF building UIs and not using Blend? Ooh. Banished. You should have a look. Have another look, honestly. Productivity-wise, wow. Wow. All that XAML that you're typing, I'm just using my mouse. And the result, well, they're pretty similar. Yes, the generation, you know, things that auto-generate your code potentially, aha, that's not very clean. But you can go and clean that up later if you wanted to. Anyway. Segue. So let's go and look at version 3. In version 3, we're in the views. We need to go and look at the results page. Try and scroll out a little bit. Select on the list box. And here is my template that I'm using for the list box item that gets rendered out on the screen. And for those people doing Silverlight and WPF, I'm using a grid. Hey, that should be cool. Yeah? I've got some rows, I've got some columns. Should be cool. But I'm getting performance problems because I'm using a grid and because I'm using columns and rows and because the UI rendering thread has to deal with the fact that this is a grid and it's got to put these rows and columns on in the side of the grid. So it's having to do more work. What are these things here? Oh. This is all vector artwork. Vector artwork, super performant, right? It is in WPF and Silverlight when I'm running on a box. When I'm running on the phone, my vector artwork isn't that great. It's actually more expensive, believe it or not. And then the whole control that I use, well, this is a list box, and potentially a list box isn't really that great at dealing with large amounts of data. So what can we do? So in version 4, what I'm going to show you is just a little control from the toolkit. This is from the original toolkit, not the new toolkit that's out there at the moment. This is from version 1. And the control that I'm now using is called a long list selector. And believe it or not, it was built to deal with long lists. So kind of makes sense for me to use that. Awesome. Okay. And that's not the only thing I've changed. Uh-oh. I've swapped the grid out and I'm using a canvas. I shouldn't really have to do that because the canvas is pretty low level. I have to position everything exactly inside of this thing. But hey, I'm on a fixed width and height piece of hardware, so it's actually not too bad for me at this moment. Canvas is lighter than a grid. The UI thread doesn't have to render all the rows and columns. It's got less to render, got less work to do. And oh, look, vector artwork has gone. It's been replaced with an image. It's faster again. So let's just go and have a look at these images as well, because there's something else I want to show you. I don't think I can increase the font size very easily on that. Sorry, guys. Okay, so the thing to note here with the images is that I put a bitmap cache on all of the images, which I can't do with vectors. So again, helps me with performance. And I know these are really, really small, shiny little pieces of polish that we're putting on, but put enough polish on and we'll see a transformed app. So I've got the cache mode there. So I've reset my data template, I've swapped the grid, removed all of the vector artwork sizzle stuff, and put the images in. And the final piece that I'm going to do here is I'm going to use this thing from David Anston, which is the low-profile image loader. Again, this is one of the great pieces of Windows Phone 7 stuff that was pushed out by different people and we've put into the contrib. And it's super simple. It's an attach property, and rather than saying source equals blah, we're saying duh, 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 your iSource equals blah. And that will deal with all of the asynchronous requests for getting the images. Okay, so that's the first bit. So we're doing some UI refactoring. Okay, next thing I want to show you very quickly is the bootstrapper. So in the bootstrapper, because we've got some additional components that we want to use in the setup of our app. Line 63, we've got this cache provider. Cache provider is something from the contrib. We've got a couple of different types. One is in memory, the other one is isolated storage. What does this mean? This means that when I start making a request, if I make a request for the same thing within a particular time frame, I'm not going to go and hit the server. I'm just going to look locally and load up the data. Saves me going and doing all this extra processing for getting the data. So that's another little refactoring that we've done. And okay, so the other thing that I want to show you is in the results view model. And yeah, let's take a look at this and then we'll move back to the other thing. So the other thing that we've done is that now we've got two asynchronous processing things happening. We've got the trickler that's dealing with all its stuff asynchronously, and we've got this low profile image loader that's dealing with all its stuff asynchronously. And obviously when we're doing that, we need to sync them back up at some point. So what we're saying is If we're scrolling, suspend the trickler. Don't put any more data into the list, the long list selector. Stop. Defer the downloads on the image loader. Don't go and get any more images because the user is scrolling. And when we scroll, we want maximum performance. We don't want to be adding stuff into the list while we do that. If we're not pending, go and execute a search. If we stop scrolling, resume the trickler, start adding things back into the long list, and go and get some more images. And that's the way we tie them up, fairly straightforward. Okay, so the final piece of this puzzle is up in the view. And the old long list selector, its composition is different to a list box. And because of the way that the control is composed, it means that we can't use our bit of stuff from Daniel. We've got to use a different technique. So what is that technique? That technique is that the long list selector, thankfully, provides a scrolling completed event and a scrolling started. And we have a little flag that you saw in the view model, which is called is scrolling, and we just set that based on when those events occur up in the view. One thing that I want to just quickly show you, which I missed before, sorry, was I spoke about transitions and that when you use a toolkit transition, sometimes you don't see those transitions happen. Whereas in the contrib, we've actually made that work. So even if you're under heavy load in your app, you'll still see the transitions happen. This is where I do it. And effectively, you know, I'm doing something simple. I'm saying, you know, when the navigate is forward and you're coming out, slide left and fade out. If you navigate and you're going backwards out, slide right and fade out. So if you're coming in and out, we'll slide in different ways depending on how you enter or exit the page. The other thing that I have is I have a callback. And what I tend to do in the callback is I null out the selected item in the list. So if the user selected something, done something, and then comes back, we remove that selection so that he's free to, she's free to scroll back up and down the list. Okay. So without further ado, let's see what happens. Okay, familiar screen, hopefully now. We're starting up, we're getting our properties. We're down at 19 megabytes. Fairly scroll smiley. You see, when I'm scrolling, I'm not adding any properties to the list. Stop scrolling, slam those in, go and get more images. We're running at 24 megabytes now. You have 50 items in the list. Come on, let's get 50 items in the list. You get more. Not dropping any frames. Move quickly. Still not dropping any frames. Move quickly again. Back up, which is the hardest one. Still not dropping any frames. So the experience we have now, not that any user will potentially scroll through things that quickly. We can do it. We can deal with large amounts of data, which is fantastic. And our memory consumption is now 25. So our memory consumption is good. So when we put in all of these other pages, we're not going to hit this 90 megabyte limit, which is nice. Okay. Sorry? Yeah, so there's 80 properties now actually in the list. No, no, no. Only if I'm at the bottom of the list. So when I scroll, when I start scrolling down and I hit 20%, I go and get more data. But if I start scrolling I'm not adding those items into the list, because as soon as I add those items into the list while I'm scrolling, the UI thread is creaking. Yes, yes. And this is one of the big things. When you're dealing with third-party APIs, I have no idea what you're going to return me. Are you return me two results? You're going to return me 200,000 results. And in the actual app that we built, there are filtering mechanisms because, you know, who in their right mind is going to scroll through 43,000 properties, you know? Yes, I guess that's a very good point. We're still adding them in, yes. Yeah, and I mean, if we try to add 43,000, yeah. We're never clearing out anything in the list. But the long list selector is doing some virtualization for us as well. So it's not keeping all of the 120 items, you know, in a list above the viewport, is only showing you sort of three below and three above, and then once you start scrolling, it'll go and put the next three in, or if you come down, it'll get the next one. It doesn't keep, you know, if we're looking at three, then there's 117 above us. It doesn't keep all of those on the canvas. It'll only bring them back as you scroll, which is why the hardest thing for us to deal with is scrolling back up the list, because it's got to go and get them from somewhere and quickly put them in there to make you think that it didn't actually remove them. Okay. Okay, so what do we see? Some good bits. Low-profile image loader is really nice and cool. All of that asynchronous stuff to go and get the images, all totally encapsulated from you. One line of XAML to do that. We've improved the UI performance, which is really good. And we've also improved the consumption of memory by putting in those techniques. And I can have a drink now. So what do we see? Hopefully you can see those values pretty well. When we first built the POC, the little prototype thing, we were running at 15 megabytes, which I still think is high for the device. But anyway, we then slapped a list box on top of our data that we were getting back. And wowee, you know, I'd actually say that the Nokia is pretty good, actually. This is on an older handset. 42 megabytes, wow. You know, we're nearly halfway to the 90 megabyte limit. We put in the trickler. We saw some improvements down at 41. But then with all of the sizzle dizzle, we came crashing down to 33. So prototype was 15, and our final piece was 33. So not bad, considering how much extra stuff that we're doing in terms of visualization. So what are the takeaways, really? If you remember anything at all, then it's all about performance, really. In order for us to get this really awesome user experience, we've got to have great performance. And hopefully some of those techniques that I showed you, you can take away and implement in your Silverlight apps, WPF apps. Important thing, keep your XAML lean. Just because you're doing it in Silverlight and WPF doesn't always mean that the XAML is lean enough for you to use when you're on the phone. As the phones get better and the platforms get better, then potentially that will fade into insignificance. But at the current time, just be quite careful of how much XAML you're putting into your templates. Create an experience that's right for the device. That's really, really important to remember when you're creating your app. And the other thing that I showed you is that all of the fundamental pieces that I used in the app and the demos today, they're all open source. Okay, nearly there. So some other contact details if you would like to get in contact, my handle on Twitter is Rich G. I have a blog which is called XAML Ninja. There's lots of sort of XAML type stuff. And my email, which is spelt incorrectly, Hotmail. I'm presuming that you know what that means, so I'm not even going to bother to redo that. And just some other bits of information which will help you find out with what's going on in Windows Phone today and how to keep up to date with the new features that are added. And that's everything from me, guys. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you.